Two soldiers appeared up above, leaning over the castle wall.
"Who goes there?" one of them shouted down at us.
"It is I, Arthur, son of Uther Pendragon, from the castle of Camelot," I recited. "King of the Britons, defeater of the Saxons, sovereign of all England."
My score jumped another 500 points, and a message informed me that I'd received a bonus for my accent and inflection. I felt myself relax, and I realized I was already having fun.
"Pull the other one," the soldier replied.
"I am," I continued, "and this is my trusty servant, Patsy. We have ridden the length and breadth of the land in search of knights who will join me in my court at Camelot. I must speak with your lord and master."
Another 500 points. In my ear, I could hear my friends giggling and applauding.
"What?"
the other soldier replied.
"Ridden on a horse?"
"Yes,"
I said, 100 points.
"You're using coconuts."
"What?"
I said, 100 points.
"You've got two empty halves of coconut, and you're banging them together."
"So? We have ridden since the snows of winter covered this land, through the Kingdom of Mercia, through..."
Another 500 points.
"Where'd you get the coconuts?"
And so it went. The character I was playing changed from one scene to the next, switching to whomever had the most dialogue. Incredibly, I flubbed only 6 or 7 lines. Each time I got stumped, all I had to do was shrug and hold out my hands, palms up, my signal that I needed some help, and H, Artemis, and Shoto would all gleefully feed me the correct line. The rest of the time, they remained silent, except for the occasional giggle fit or burst of laughter. The only really difficult part was not laughing myself, especially when Artemis started doing note-perfect recitations of all of Carol Cleveland's lines in the castle anthrax scene. I cracked up a few times and got hit with score penalties for it. Otherwise, it was smooth sailing. Reenacting the film wasn't just easy, it was a total blast. About halfway through the movie, right after my confrontation with the Knights of Ni, I opened up a text window on my display and typed, "Status on the Sixers?" 15 of them are still playing Tempest," I heard H reply, "but 3 of them beat Halliday's score and are now inside the Grail simulation." A brief pause. "And the leader, Sorrento, we think, is running just 9 minutes behind you." "And so far he hasn't missed a single line of dialogue," Shoto added. I nearly cursed out loud, then caught myself and typed, "Shit!" "Exactly," Artemis said. I took a deep breath and returned my attention to the next scene. The Tale of Sir Lancelot. H continued to give me updates on the Sixers whenever I asked for them. When I reached the film's final scene, the assault on the French castle, I grew anxious again, wondering what would happen next. The first gate had required me to reenact a movie, War Games, and the second gate had contained a video game challenge, Black Tiger. So far, the third gate had contained both. I knew there must be a third stage, but I had no idea what it might be. I got my answer a few minutes later. As soon as I completed Holy Grail's final scene, my display went black while the silly organ music that ends the film played for a few minutes. When the music stopped, the following appeared on my display. "Congratulations! You have reached the end. Ready, player one." And then, as the text faded away, I found myself standing in a huge, oak-paneled room, as big as a warehouse, with a high vaulted ceiling and a polished hardwood floor. The room had no windows and only one exit. Large, double doors set into one of the 4 bare walls. An older high-end Oasis immersion rig stood in the absolute center of the expansive room. Over 100 glass tables surrounded the rig, arranged in a large oval around it. On each table, there was a different classic home computer or video game system, accompanied by tiered racks that appeared to hold a complete collection of its peripherals, controllers, software, and games. All of it was arranged perfectly, like a museum exhibit. Looking around the circle, from one system to the next, I saw that the computers seemed to be arranged roughly by year of origin. A PDP-1, an Altair 8800, an IMSI 8080, an Apple I right next to an Apple II, an Atari 2600, a Commodore PET, an Intellivision, several different TRS-80 models, an Atari 400 and 800, a ColecoVision, a TI-99-4, a Sinclair ZX-80, a Commodore 64, various Nintendo and Sega game systems, the entire lineage of Macs and PCs, PlayStations and Xboxes. Finally, completing the circle was an Oasis console, connected to the immersion rig in the center of the room. I realized that I was standing in a recreation of James Halliday's office, the room in his mansion where he'd spent most of the last 15 years of his life, the place where he'd coded his last and greatest game, the one I was now playing. I'd never seen any photos of this room, but its layout and contents had been described in great detail by the movers hired to clear the place out after Halliday's death. I looked down at my avatar and saw that I no longer appeared as one of the Monty Python knights. I was Parzival once again. First, I did the obvious and tried the exit. The doors wouldn't budge. I turned back and took another long look around the room, surveying the long line of monuments to the history of computing and video games. That was when I realized that the oval-shaped ring in which they were arranged actually formed the outline of an egg. In my head, I recited the words of Halliday's first riddle, the one in Anorak's invitation. Three hidden keys open three secret gates, wherein the errant will be tested for worthy traits. And those with the skill to survive these straits will reach the end where the prize awaits. I'd reached the end. This was it. Halliday's Easter egg must be hidden somewhere in this room. Chapter 38. "Do you guys see this?" I whispered. There was no reply. "Hello? H? Artemis? Shoto? Are you guys still there?" Still no reply. Either Og had cut their voice links to me, or Halliday had coded this final stage of the gate so that no outside communication was possible. I was pretty sure it was the latter. I stood there in silence for a minute, unsure of what to do. Then I followed my first instinct and walked over to the Atari 2600. It was hooked up to a 1977 Zenith color TV. I turned on the TV, but nothing happened. Then I switched on the Atari. Still nothing. There was no power, even though both the TV and the Atari were plugged into electrical outlets set into the floor. I tried the Apple II on the table beside it. It wouldn't switch on either. After a few minutes of experimentation, I discovered that the only computer that would power on was one of the oldest, the IMSI 8080, the same model of computer Matthew Broderick owned in War Games. When I booted it up, the screen was completely blank, save for one word: login. I typed in Anorak and hit enter. Identification not recognized. Connection terminated. Then the computer shut itself off, and I had to power it back on to get the login prompt again. I tried Halliday. No dice. In War Games, the backdoor password that had granted access to the Whopper supercomputer was Joshua, Professor Falcon, the creator of the Whopper, had used the name of his son for the password, the person he loved most in the world. I typed in Og. It didn't work. Ogden didn't work either. I typed in Kira and hit the enter key. Identification not recognized. Connection terminated. I tried each of his parents' first names. I tried Zaphod, the name of his pet fish. Then Tiberius, the name of a ferret he'd once owned. None of them worked. I checked the time. I'd been in this room for over 10 minutes now, which meant that Sorrento had caught up with me. So he would now be inside his own separate copy of this room, probably with a team of Halliday scholars whispering suggestions in his ear thanks to his hacked immersion rig. They were probably already working from a prioritized list of possibilities, entering them as fast as Sorrento could type. I was out of time. I clenched my teeth in frustration. I had no idea what to try next. Then I remembered a line from Ogden Morrow's biography. The opposite sex made Jim extremely nervous, and Kira was the only girl that I ever saw him speak to in a relaxed manner. But even then, it was only in character, as Anorak, during the course of our gaming sessions, and he would only address her as Lucosia, the name of her D&D character. I rebooted the computer again. When the login prompt reappeared, I typed in Lucosia. Then I hit the enter key. Every system in the room powered itself on. The sounds of whirring disk drives, self-test beeps, and other boot-up sounds echoed off the vaulted ceiling. I ran back over to the Atari 2600 and searched through the giant rack of alphabetized game cartridges beside it until I found the one I was looking for. Adventure. I shoved it into the Atari and turned the system on, then hit the reset switch to start the game. It took me only a few minutes to reach the secret room. I grabbed the sword and used it to slay all three of the dragons. Then I found the black key, opened the gates of the Black Castle, and ventured into its labyrinth. The gray dot was hidden right where it was supposed to be. I picked it up and carried it back across the tiny 8-bit kingdom, then used it to pass through the magic barrier and enter the secret room. But unlike the original Atari game, this secret room didn't contain the name of Warren Robinette, Adventure's original programmer. Instead, at the very center of the screen, there was a large white oval with pixelated edges. An egg. The egg. I stared at the TV screen in stunned silence for a moment. Then I pulled the Atari joystick to the right, moving my tiny square avatar across the flickering screen. The TV's mono speaker emitted a brief electronic bip sound as I dropped the gray dot and picked up the egg. As I did, there was a brilliant flash of light, and then I saw that my avatar was no longer holding a joystick. Now, cupped in both of my hands, was a large, silver egg. I could see my avatar's warped reflection on its curved surface. When I finally managed to stop staring at it, I looked up and saw that the double doors on the other side of the room had been replaced with the gate exit, a crystal-edged portal leading back into the foyer of Castle Anorak. The castle appeared to have been completely restored, even though the Oasis server still wouldn't reset for several more hours. I took one last look around Halliday's office. Then, still clutching the egg in my hands, I walked across the room and stepped through the exit. As soon as I was through it, I turned around just in time to see the crystal gate transform into a large wooden door set into the castle wall. I opened the wooden door. Beyond it, there was a spiral staircase that that led up to the top of Castle Anorak's tallest tower. There, I found Anorak's study. Towering shelves lined the room, filled with ancient scrolls and dusty spellbooks. I walked over to the window and looked out on a stunning view of the surrounding landscape. It was no longer barren. The effects of the cataclysm had been undone, and all of Thonia appeared to have been restored along with the castle. I looked around the room. Directly beneath the familiar black dragon painting, there was an ornate crystal pedestal on which rested a gold chalice encrusted with tiny jewels. Its diameter matched that of the silver egg I held in my hands. I placed the egg in the chalice, and it fit perfectly. In the distance, I heard a fanfare of trumpets, and the egg began to glow. "You win," I heard a voice say. I turned and saw that Anorak was standing right behind me. His obsidian black robes seemed to pull most of the sunlight out of the room. "Congratulations," he said, stretching out his long-fingered hand. I hesitated, wondering if this was another trick, or perhaps one final test. "The game is over," Anorak said, as if he'd read my mind. "It's time for you to receive your prize." I looked down at his outstretched hand. Then, after a moment's hesitation, I took it. Cascading bolts of blue lightning erupted in the space between us, and their spiderweb tines enveloped us both, as if a surge of power were passing from his avatar into mine. When the lightning subsided, I saw that Anorak was no longer dressed in his black wizard's robes. In fact, he no longer looked like Anorak at all. He was shorter, thinner, and somewhat less handsome. Now, he looked like James Halliday. Pale, middle-aged, he was dressed in worn jeans and a faded Space Invaders t-shirt. I looked down at my own avatar and discovered that I was now wearing Anorak's robes. Then I realized that the icons and readouts around the edge of my display had also changed. My stats were all completely maxed out, and I now had a list of spells, inherent powers, and magic items that seemed to scroll on forever. My avatar's level and hit point counters both had infinity symbols in front of them, and my credit readout now displayed a number 12 digits long. I was a multi-billionaire. "I'm entrusting the care of the Oasis to you now, Parzival," Halliday said. "Your avatar is immortal and all-powerful. Whatever you want, all you have to do is wish for it." "Pretty sweet, eh?" He leaned toward me and lowered his voice. "Do me a favor. Try and use your powers only for good. Okay?" "Okay," I said, in a voice that was barely a whisper. Halliday smiled, then gestured around us. "This is your castle now. I've coded this room so that only your avatar can enter it. I did this to ensure that you alone have access to this." He walked over to a bookshelf against the wall and pulled on the spine of one of the volumes it held. I heard a click. Then the bookshelf slid aside, revealing a square metal plate set into the wall. In the center of the plate, there was a comically large red button, embossed with a single word, "Off." "I call this the Big Red Button," Halliday said. "If you press it, it will shut off the entire Oasis and launch a worm that will delete everything stored on the GSS servers, including all of the Oasis source code. It will shut down the Oasis forever. He smirked. So don't press it unless you're absolutely positive it's the right thing to do. Okay? He gave me an odd smile. I trust your judgment. Halliday slid the bookshelf back into place, concealing the button once again. Then he startled me by putting his arm around my shoulders. Listen, he said, adopting a confidential tone. I need to tell you one last thing before I go. Something I didn't figure out for myself until it was already too late. He led me over to the window and motioned out at the landscape stretching out beyond it. I created the Oasis because I never felt at home in the real world. I didn't know how to connect with the people there. I was afraid for all of my life, right up until I knew it was ending. That was when I realized, as terrifying and painful as reality can be, it's also the only place where you can find true happiness. Because reality is real. Do you understand? Yes, I said. I think I do. Good, he said, giving me a wink. Don't make the same mistake I did. Don't hide in here forever. He smiled and took a few steps away from me. All right, I think that covers everything. It's time for me to blow this pop stand. Then, Halliday began to disappear. He smiled and waved goodbye as his avatar slowly faded out of existence. Good luck, Parzival, he said. And thanks. Thanks for playing my game. Then, he was completely gone. Are you guys there? I said to the empty air a few minutes later. Yes, H said excitedly. Can you hear us? Yeah, I can now. What happened? The system cut off our voice links to you as soon as you entered Halliday's office, so we couldn't talk to you. Luckily, you didn't need our help anyway, Shoto said. Good job, man. Congratulations, Wade, I heard Artemis say, and I could tell she meant it too. Thanks, I said, but I couldn't have done it without you guys. You're right, Artemis said. Remember to mention that when you talk to the media. Og says there are a few hundred reporters on their way here right now. I glanced back over at the bookshelf that concealed the big red button. Did you guys see everything Halliday said to me before he vanished? I asked. No, Artemis said. We saw everything up until he told you to try and use your powers only for good. Then your vid feed cut out. What happened after that? Nothing much, I said. I'll tell you about it later. Dude, H said, you've got to check the scoreboard. I opened a window and pulled up the scoreboard. The list of high scores was gone. Now, the only thing displayed on Halliday's website was an image of my avatar dressed in Anorak's robes holding the silver egg, along with the words, Parzival wins. What happened to the Sixers? I asked. The ones who were still inside the gate? We're not sure, H said. Their vid feeds vanished when the scoreboard changed. Maybe their avatars were killed, Shoto said. Or maybe... Maybe they were just ejected from the gate, I said. I pulled up my map of Thonia and saw that I could now teleport anywhere in the Oasis simply by selecting my desired destination in the Atlas. I zoomed in on Castle Anorak and tapped a spot just outside the front entrance, and in a blink, my avatar was standing there. I was right. When I'd cleared the third gate, the 18 Sixer avatars who were still inside had been ejected from the gate and deposited in front of the castle. They were all standing there with confused looks on their faces when I appeared in front of them, resplendent in my new threads. They all stared at me in silence for a few seconds, then pulled out guns and swords, preparing to attack. They all looked identical, so I couldn't tell which one was being controlled by Sorrento, but at this point, I didn't really care. Using my avatar's new super user interface, I made a sweeping gesture with my hand, selecting all of the Sixer avatars on my display. Their outlines began to glow red. Then I tapped the skull and crossbones icon that now appeared on my avatar's toolbar. All 18 Sixer avatars instantly dropped dead. Their bodies slowly faded out of existence, each leaving behind a tiny pile of weapons and loot.
"Holy shit," I heard Shoto say over the comlink. "How did you do that?"
"You heard Halliday," H said. "His avatar is immortal and all-powerful." "Yeah," I said. "He wasn't kidding either."
"Halliday also said you could wish for whatever you wanted," H said. "What are you going to wish for first?"
I thought about that for a second. Then I tapped the new command icon that now appeared at the edge of my display and said, "I wish for H, Artemis, and Shoto to be resurrected." A dialogue window popped up, asking me to confirm the spelling of each of their avatar names. Once I did, the system asked me if, in addition to resurrecting their avatars, I wanted to restore all of their lost items, too. I tapped the yes icon. Then, a message appeared in the center of my display. "Resurrection complete. Avatars restored."
"Guys," I said, "you might want to try logging back into your accounts now."
"We're already on our way," H shouted. A few seconds later, Shoto logged back into his account, and his avatar materialized a short distance in front of me, in the exact spot where he'd been killed a few hours earlier. He ran over to me, grinning from ear to ear.
"Arigato, Pazival-san," he said, bowing low.
I returned the bow, then threw my arms around him.
"Welcome back," I said.
A moment later, H emerged from the castle entrance and ran over to join us.
"Good as new," he said, grinning down at his restored avatar.
"Thanks, Z."
"De nada."
I glanced back through the castle's open entrance.
"Where's Artemis?"
"She should have reappeared right next to you."
"She didn't log back in," H said. "She said she wanted to go outside and get some fresh air."
"You saw her? What?"
I searched for the right words.
"How did she look?"
They both just smiled at me. Then H rested a hand on my shoulder. "She said she'd be outside waiting for you, whenever you're ready to meet her." I nodded. I was about to tap my logout icon when H held up his hand.
"Wait a second. Before you log out, you've got to see something," he said, opening a window in front of me. "This is airing on all of the news feeds right now. The feds just took Sorrento in for questioning. They stormed into IOI headquarters and yanked him right out of his haptic chair."
A video clip began to play. Handheld camera footage showed a team of federal agents leading Sorrento across the lobby of the IOI corporate headquarters. He was still wearing his haptic suit and was shadowed by a gray-haired man in a suit who I assumed was his attorney. Sorrento looked annoyed more than anything, as if this were all just a mild inconvenience. The caption along the bottom of the window read, "Top IOI Executive Sorrento Accused of Murder." The news feeds have been playing clips from the sim cap of your chat link session with Sorrento all day, H said, pausing the clip. "Especially the part where he threatens to kill you and then blows up your aunt's trailer." H hit play, and the news clip continued. The federal agents continued to usher Sorrento through the lobby, which was packed with reporters, all pushing against one another and shouting questions. The reporter shooting the video we were watching lunged forward and jammed the camera in Sorrento's face. "Did you give the order to kill Wade Watts personally?" the reporter shouted. "How does it feel to know you just lost the contest?" Sorrento smiled, but didn't reply. Then his attorney stepped in front of the camera and addressed the reporters. "The charges leveled against my client are preposterous," he said. "The SIM cap being circulated is clearly a doctored fake. We have no other comment at this time." Sorrento nodded. He continued to smile as the feds led him out of the building. "The bastard will probably get off scot-free," I said. "IOI can afford to hire the best lawyers in the world." "Yes, they can," H said. Then he flashed his Cheshire grin. "But now, so can we." Chapter 39. When I stepped out of the immersion bay, Og was standing there waiting for me. "Well done, Wade," he said, pulling me into a crushing bear hug. "Well done." "Thanks, Og." I was still dazed and felt unsteady on my feet. "Several chief executives from GSS arrived while you were logged in," Og said, "along with all of Jim's lawyers. They're all waiting upstairs. As you can imagine, they're anxious to speak with you."
"Do I have to talk to them right now?"
"No, of course not," he laughed. "They all work for you now, remember? Make the bastards wait as long as you like." He leaned forward. "My lawyer is up there, too. He's a good guy, a real pit bull. He'll make sure that no one messes with you, okay?"
"Thanks, Og," I said. "I really owe you."
"Nonsense," he said. "I should be thanking you. I haven't had this much fun in decades. You did good, kid." I glanced around uncertainly. H and Shoto were still in their immersion bays, holding an impromptu online press conference. But Artemis's bay was empty. I turned back to Og.
"Do you know which way Artemis went?"
Og grinned at me, then pointed. "Up those stairs and out the first door you see," he said. "She said she'd wait for you at the center of my hedge maze," he smiled. "It's an easy maze. It shouldn't take you very long to find her." I stepped outside and squinted as my eyes adjusted to the light. The air was warm, and the sun was already high overhead. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was a beautiful day. The hedge maze covered several acres of land behind the mansion. The entrance was designed to look like the facade of a castle, and you entered the maze through its open gates. The dense hedge walls that comprised the maze were 10 feet tall, making it impossible to peek over them, even if you stood on top of one of the benches placed throughout the labyrinth. I entered the maze and wandered around in circles for a few minutes, confused. Eventually, I realized that the maze's layout was identical to the labyrinth in Adventure. After that, it took me only a few more minutes to find my way to the large open area at the maze's center. A large fountain stood there, with a detailed stone sculpture of Adventure's 3 duck-shaped dragons. Each dragon was spitting a stream of water instead of breathing fire. And then I saw her. She was sitting on a stone bench, staring into the fountain. She had her back to me, and her head was tilted down. Her long black hair spilled down over her right shoulder. I could see that she was kneading her hands in her lap. I was afraid to move any closer. Finally, I worked up the courage to speak. "Hello," I said. She lifted her head at the sound of my voice, but didn't turn around. "Hello," I heard her say. And it was her voice. Artemis's voice. The voice I'd spent so many hours listening to. And that gave me the courage to step forward. I walked around the fountain and stopped once I was standing directly in front of her. As she heard me approach, she turned her head away, averting her eyes,
and keeping me out of her field of vision. But I could see her. She looked just as she had in the photo I'd seen. She had the same Rubenesque body, the same pale, freckled skin, the same hazel eyes and raven hair, the same beautiful round face with the same reddish birthmark. But unlike in that photo, she wasn't trying to hide the birthmark with a sweep of her hair. She had her hair brushed back, so I could see it. I waited in silence, but she still wouldn't look up at me. "You look just like I always pictured you," I said. "Beautiful." "Really?" she said, softly. Slowly, she turned to face me, taking in my appearance a little at a time, starting with my feet, and then gradually working her way up to my face. When our eyes finally met, she smiled at me nervously. "Well, what do you know? You look just like I always thought you would, too," she said. "But ugly." We both laughed, and most of the tension in the air dissipated. Then we stared into each other's eyes for what seemed like a long time. It was, I realized, also the very first time. "We haven't been formally introduced," she said. "I'm Samantha." "Hello, Samantha. I'm Wade." "It's nice to finally meet you in person, Wade." She patted the bench beside her, and I sat down. After a long silence, she said, "So, what happens now?" I smiled. "We're going to use all of the moolah we just won to feed everyone on the planet. We're going to make the world a better place, right?" She grinned. "Don't you want to build a huge interstellar spaceship, load it full of video games, junk food, and comfy couches, and then get the hell out of here?" "I'm up for that, too," I said. "If it means I get to spend the rest of my life with you." She gave me a shy smile. "We'll have to see," she said. "We just met, you know." "I'm in love with you." Her lower lip started to tremble. "You're sure about that?" "Yes, I am. Because it's true." She smiled at me, but I also saw that she was crying. "I'm sorry for breaking things off with you," she said. "For disappearing from your life. It's okay," I said. "I understand why you did it now." She looked relieved. "You do?" I nodded. "You did the right thing." "You think so?" "We won, didn't we?" She smiled at me, and I smiled back. "Listen," I said. "We can take things as slow as you like. I'm really a nice guy once you get to know me. I swear." She laughed and wiped away a few of her tears, but she didn't say anything. "Did I mention that I'm also extremely rich?" I said. "Of course, so are you, so I don't suppose that's a big selling point." "You don't need to sell me on anything, Wade," she said. "You're my best friend. My favorite person." With what appeared to be some effort, she looked me in the eye. "I've really missed you, you know that?" My heart felt like it was on fire. I took a moment to work up my courage. Then I reached out and took her hand. We sat there a while, holding hands, reveling in the strange new sensation of actually touching one another. Some time later, she leaned over and kissed me. It felt just like all those songs and poems had promised it would. It felt wonderful, like being being struck by lightning. It occurred to me then that for the first time in as long as I could remember, I had absolutely no desire to log back into the oasis. This is Will Wheaton. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. This program was directed by Tony Huds. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text, copyright 2011 by Dark All Day, Incorporated. Production, copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.